Good afternoon, and welcome to the December meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout in Northport on the coast of Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the president of the forum. Since 1985, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of foreign service, journalism, or academia talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum, that's all one word, .org. Today, we're happy to have with us Stephen Kinzer. He's an award-winning foreign correspondent who's covered more than 50 countries in five continents. His numerous articles and many books have led the Washington Post to place him, quote, among the best in popular foreign policy storytelling. From 1983 to 89, Kinzer was the Times bureau chief in Nicaragua. In that post, he covered war and upheaval in Central America. From 1990 to 1996, Stephen was posted in Germany, chief of the New York Times bureau in Bonn, and after German unification, became chief of the Berlin bureau. From there, he covered the emergence of post-communist Europe, including wars in the former Yugoslavia. In 1996, he was named chief of the newly opened New York Times Bureau in Istanbul. He spent 4 years there, traveling widely in Turkey and in the new nations of Central Asia and the Caucasus. After completing this assignment, he published Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds. His most recent book, which was published this past summer, is Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. And that is the topic of his talk today. Before he gets up here and talks, I want to remind you that we've got a number of his books for sale out there in the hall, which he will be delighted to sign after the talk. Stephen, please come up. We're delighted to have you.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Mac. It's great to be up here and see what a vibrant community of people interested in the world that we have up here. That's so important for America. It's often said that Americans are ignorant about the outside world. I don't know how anyone would get that idea. I think our real problem is not just our ignorance. Ignorance alone is lamentable, but not necessarily dangerous. If people in, let's say, Paraguay don't know anything about Iran, that's unfortunate, that's their loss, but it really doesn't affect the course of world events. But when people in the United States are ignorant, that's very dangerous because we act on our ignorance. Therefore, I think Americans have a particular responsibility in the world, seeing you all out here makes me think that maybe despite all the depressing news of the day, there is some vibrancy and some desire to remain engaged in these crucial issues of global policy. One of the immutable patterns of world history is the rise and fall of great powers and great nations and great empires. We seem to think because of our short history and because the curve of our history has been so positive that this is a permanent situation for us. We're always going to be on top. We're always going to enjoy the things that we've enjoyed all our lives. The world doesn't work that way, and history books are full of obituaries for countries and nations and empires that were unable to adapt to a changing world. This is exactly the challenge that faces America today. I had my own challenge getting up here in the snow. It was a great Maine welcome. A little bit better, however, than the welcome I had when I showed up in Iran a few months ago. As many of you know, I've been very engaged in Iran and try to go there as often as possible. But after the unpleasantness of last year, the Iran government decided to stop issuing visas for American journalists. So I was very eager to get there. I need to stay in touch with what people in Iran are thinking and saying. But on the other hand, there are no journalist visas to be obtained. So what do I do? Well, I was actually sitting at home musing on this problem when I received an email from a travel agency in California that's one of the few travel agencies in America that organizes tours to Iran. And they said, would you like to be a tour guide for our next group going to Iran? So I thought, this is the perfect situation. So I'm a journalist, but I can get into Iran as a tourist, and they won't know, and I'll be able to get around and talk to people, and everything's fine. So I said, yes, happy to do it. When the time came, I flew to Frankfurt and waited a couple of hours at the airport, then got on the plane to Tehran. Several other members of my tour group were on the plane, and we arrived in Tehran about 3 o'clock in the morning. They have a system at the Tehran airport for Americans who arrive. They put their passports aside, and they ask you very politely if you would just wait on the sofa over there, and we'll get to your passports when we're finished with everyone else. So we sat over there for a while, and then it was a little while longer. And finally, a young kid in a military uniform came out very apologetically and said, I'm really sorry for the delay, but there's a problem with one passport. I sat there, and I looked at my friends and told them, I can guarantee you it's me. It reminded me of that story about Jonah and the whale. So there's a big storm, and everyone on the boat knows there's one sinner on board. Who is it? I was the sinner. Sure enough, 10 minutes later, the kid comes back out, and he says, my boss would like to see with Mr. Kinzer. So I went in, and sure enough, he had a laptop, and he had my passport, and he looked up at me and said, you are a journalist, but you are trying to enter our country on a tourist visa. Why? So I started to explain to him, this must be a big misunderstanding, and of course, I'm only here to guide tourists, and I tried to lie to him as convincingly as I could. Unfortunately, he was on to me. He understood the situation very well, and all of my bag of journalist tricks, which I've accumulated over decades as a foreign correspondent, did not work, did not move him. And I kept saying, but I have to get in, and my tourists are here, I'm here as a tour guide. He was not buying it. And finally, at the end of our long conversation, he said, listen, let me lay it out to you directly. There's a flight going back to Frankfurt in about 5 hours. If you agree to go back on that flight and go back to Frankfurt, I'm going to give you this pass, and you can sit in the first class lounge for 5 hours and wait for the plane to depart. If you don't agree, we're going to put you in jail. To which the young kid beside him piped up, it's not really a jail, it's just a detention center. But it's not very nice. So I sat there for a minute and tried to weigh my options. So first class lounge, Iranian detention center that's not very nice. Finally I decided, okay, I'm going to take the first class lounge. I did sit there for 5 hours staring at the sign over the departure gateway that says, this revolution is not recognized anywhere in the world without the name of Imam Khomeini. Have a nice trip. I didn't quite get the connection, but I stared at that for a few hours, and sure enough, they threw me out of the country. I wanted to tell the guy, I've been thrown out of better countries than this, but it's not true, really. I've been thrown out of other countries, but never any country as cool as Iran. So I had to go back to Frankfurt, and I called my travel agency and told them what happened. They went into a panic, and they told me, just sit there. We're going to try to work it out. And it's a long story. I don't really even want to know how that sausage was made. But ultimately, they called me 2 days later and said, OK, it's all set. Get on another plane, go back to Tehran, and you're going to get in this time. And sure enough, I went right through the airport, no problem. So I did get to spend a couple of weeks traveling around Iran. That was just a few months ago. That's a fascinating experience. I used to say that Iran, that the people of Iran are the most pro-American people of any people in the whole Middle East. But now I'm actually willing to go further. I'm going to continue saying this until someone contradicts me. I believe the people of Iran are more pro-American than the people of any country in the whole world. I've never been to any other country where when you tell people you're American, suddenly, within a few seconds, you're surrounded by swooning people and screaming people who are saying things like, as one woman said to me on a street corner in Shiraz, we know they say terrible things about us over there, but we love America so much. I mean, people won't even say that in Canada. So the pro-American sentiment in Iran is widespread and intense, that they are so tuned into what America has, and they want the freedoms that we have. They're tied into American popular culture. One of my friends is a journalist who recently accompanied Sean Penn, the actor, on a trip to Iran. And he said that, he told me this story. We were in the bazaar in Isfahan, he said, and we were going from one stall to another looking at the wares. And as we were leaving one stall where we had talked with this elderly gentleman whose young grandson spoke English and was translating for us, suddenly the grandson calls out to us and he says, excuse me, can you come back here please for a minute? So they turned around and they went back to the stall, and the kid says, my grandfather has a question he wants to ask you. So they said, okay. Then the grandson and the grandfather talk in Farsi for a minute, and the grandson then turns to them and says, my grandfather wants to know, what was it like being married to Madonna? I didn't even know Sean Penn was married to Madonna. So that shows you that this is the opposite of the country of America haters that maybe we tend to imagine that it is from the headlines in the newspapers. This pro-American sentiment in Iran is a huge strategic asset for us. Whatever we do in the future, we should do nothing to endanger this asset. This asset will pay great benefits to us in the long run. It's also an interesting fact, this pro-American sentiment in Iran, because it underlines how misguided our pattern of alliances in the world has become. And this is nowhere more visible than in the Middle East. We have a Middle East policy that was shaped to deal with the Cold War. The Cold War is over. The strategic environment in the Middle East has changed tremendously. There are terrifying new threats emerging from that region. But there are also tantalizing opportunities out there if we're only able to open our minds and take advantage of them. We are now carrying out an approach to the Middle East which brings to mind that great quote from Albert Einstein. He once defined insanity as doing the same thing over and over but expecting different results. That's our policy toward the Middle East. We're all set to deal with the Middle East of 1980, but we are not set to deal with the Middle East as it exists now, and we're not looking forward to the Middle East of the future. What might be an alternative approach for us? First of all, I think there is a widespread understanding, including in Washington, that our approach to the Middle East isn't working. All you have to do is read the morning paper, and you can see the Middle East is a pit of violence and hatred and intensifying anger. And you can see that whatever outside powers are doing is not working. America's long-term strategic goal in the Middle East, above all, is stability. We're not getting there. We're going in the opposite direction. So our policies are outmoded. They're shaped to deal with an era that's over, but we haven't thought of what would be a new policy. So that's my starting point. And I think that that piece, at least, is widely acknowledged and fairly evident. Then you come to the question of what would be a new approach to the world's most turbulent region and the region where we, as the United States, face our most frustrating overseas challenges. One of the things I believe is that we should give up the idea that we alone understand the Middle East. This really has been an underlying foundation of our approach to that part of the world. We feel that we get the Middle East. Other countries don't get it. They don't see what's happening there, including the countries that are in that region. They don't get it either. We're the only ones that really see the region clearly. Now, there was a time during the Cold War when we were able to get countries to do what we wanted very easily because of the power dynamic and the world strategic situation at that time. It was very easy for us to get countries to do what was good for us instead of doing what was good for them. That was the power balance at that time. Those days are now over. We cannot make people do or make countries do what's good for us. They want to do what's good for them now. So this requires more compromise. This requires us to be a little bit more adroit. The countries that survive long periods in history are countries that adapt as the world changes. This is the great challenge facing the United States now. But we've been on a certain path in our national history, which is, has been very short, that has led us to believe we don't need to change. We are apart from the patterns of history. The greatness and the prosperity and the freedom that we've enjoyed over the past century is a permanent thing. It's always going to be like this. History books are littered with the obituaries of countries and nations and empires that believed this fallacy. You need to change and modernize and adjust to a changing world. One way I think we should change is look for other countries that we can work with, that are partners, that can be partners of ours and also advisors of ours. We're not used to looking for advisors. We only give advice. We're not good at taking it. In the Middle East, however, it's time for us to work with others and try to shape a policy that will create a new security architecture for the 21st century. Now, who might those countries be? When you're looking for partners in the world, I think you look for countries that fill two criteria. The first is you want a country whose society looks something like yours, a country that is based on fundamental principles that you can recognize. This brings you to look very skeptically at some of our so-called allies. Saudi Arabia, for example, is not a country any of us would recognize. This is a country with an absolute monarchy where dating is illegal and women are forbidden to drive. It's not a society that any of us would recognize. Our alliance with them is just an alliance between ruling elites. The peoples have nothing in common. If you look around the Muslim Middle East and you look for societies that look like ours, societies that are open and that have modern, progressive ideas, you really find only two. The two that are the most vibrant are Turkey and Iran. Turkey is the world's most democratic Muslim country. Of the 52 Muslim countries, it has done the most in progressing towards democracy. It's also a thriving capitalist state. Turkey's economy is booming. Turkey will grow this year at the second highest rate in the world. Only China is growing faster than Turkey. So Turkey is a country with a multi-party democracy, and Turkey really is a country that has managed to change with the times. That is the key to Turkey's success as a nation. Turkey was founded as an authoritarian state under Atatürk when the idea of authoritarianism was ascendant in the 1920s and 30s. After World War II, the world didn't want authoritarian states anymore. You had to be democratic to get into the UN. Turkey did something I don't think any country in modern history has ever done. They transformed themselves from a one-party state into a multi-party state voluntarily. They had a multi-party election in 1950. And the party that had been in power since the country was founded lost the election. And their leaders left office and the new group came in. So Turkey transformed itself into a multi-party state. Its economy was still very closed, but in the 1980s, when the world didn't tolerate that anymore, a visionary president of Turkey, Turgut Özal, opened up the Turkish economy and started the boom that is now producing such tremendous economic results in Turkey. In the 1990s, the world embraced the religion of human rights. That was a time, I'm sure many of you can still remember, when we used to read a lot of stories about people being tortured in Turkish prisons. You don't read those stories anymore. Turkey realized they had to evolve past that. So Turkey could be a great example for us if we were looking for examples of countries that adapt as the world changes. So their society is very similar to ours. And Iranian society, as I described a few minutes ago, also is amazingly vibrant. Civil society is highly sophisticated. And high rates of literacy are prevalent in Iran. Women are dominant in Iran. The situation has gotten so bad in Iranian universities, where entry is only by competitive examination, that they're now thinking of imposing an affirmative action program to be sure there's some men left in the university. When you go into Iranian businesses, everybody working there is female. So that's the beginning of a trend the whole world is going to see. I mean, the marginalization of men is probably going to be a salutary development, but Iran is leading the world among other things in that one. Iranian democratic society has not managed to produce a democratic government. Turkish democratic society has produced a democratic government. Why that is could be the subject for another talk, but I might be able to summarize that talk, if you want, in just one word. Oil. We sometimes read about countries being blessed with resources. Forget that. Countries are cursed often with resources, and Iran is a great example. When Iran is sitting on an ocean of oil, that has meant that it has been the subject of attacks and interventions from foreign powers all during this century. And there's probably no country in the world that's more sensitive to the idea of foreign intervention than Iran because of this history. Iran had something valuable that rich countries wanted to steal. That made it impossible for weak democracy to consolidate itself because outside powers wanted to impose dictatorship on Iran to make sure we got our oil. And that has been remarkably successful. The last 50 years, Iran has been under first royal dictatorship and then Islamic rule. Turkey has nothing the world wants to steal. That's why Turkey has managed to develop its democracy. So these are the two societies in the Muslim Middle East that have the most democratic popular cultures. In that sense, they're logical partners for us. So that's one thing you should be looking for in a partner, a society that's like yours. The other thing you should be looking for is a country whose long-term strategic goals are parallel to your own. Now, trying to sell Turkey as a country that shares our strategic values is not that difficult. Turkey has been our NATO ally for more than 50 years. Turkey has been at our side all through the Cold War. They fought with us in Korea. Turkey's example is so important to us. If you could ask Americans or people planning American policy what we would like people in Iran or Syria or Egypt or Libya to think about what they'd like their country to become in the future, what we want them to think is we'd like to be more like Turkey. Turkish example is really important in the Islamic world because Turkey is the living refutation of two very important Orientalist theses. One is Islam is not compatible with democracy. The other is Islam is not compatible with capitalism. If you want to believe those two things, don't go to Turkey, because Turkey proves that they're wrong. Turkey is a 99% Islamic country with a booming capitalist economy and a very lively democratic political system. So the Turkish example is very important to project in the world. The more we can do to promote the Turkish example, the better it is for us. And even when Turkey disagrees with us on some policy issues, in the long run, even that is good for us because it allows Turkey to travel to other Muslim countries and make clear we're speaking for ourselves. We are not lackeys of Washington. So that's positive for us. Turkey is a country that has advice for us, particularly when it comes to dealing with Iran. Their advice, simply put, is something like this. Listen, we're on your side, America. We want to help you. Including in the Middle East, we want to help you. But you've got to rethink your approach to Iran. You've got to drop the confrontational rhetoric. You've got to be more diplomatic. You've got to be more open to compromise. You want stability in this region. We want stability even more than you do because we're in this region. And Turkey has this huge economic project of going from being the 16th biggest economy in the world to getting into the top 10. That's their obsession. If they don't have a stable Middle East, they can't get there. So they're telling Americans, let us help you stabilize this region. We begin by calming down the confrontation with Iran. Unfortunately, the United States is not good at taking advice. We haven't even gotten to the point where we want to hear what our friends say, much less actually analyze their advice. So as I said, positing Turkey as a long-term partner for the U.S. and the Middle East is a pretty easy sell. But how about Iran? Iran's long-term security interests, and these are state interests that do not change as regimes change, are much more parallel in the long run to American interests than the interests of some of our so-called friends in that part of the world. Those of you that have been reading the WikiLeaks for the last few days, for example, are very aware that Saudi Arabia, our dear ally, is the number one source of funding for Al-Qaeda. We cannot convince Saudi Arabia to crack down on funding for Al-Qaeda. This is what I just read in this morning's newspaper, according to cables from American diplomats. This is our dear friend. This is the country we're now selling $60 billion worth of arms to in the greatest arms sale in human history. Who knows who's going to be in charge of Saudi Arabia in the future? If there were a free election in Saudi Arabia today, their most famous citizen, Osama bin Laden, might well get elected. He could be elected president of Saudi Arabia. So this is the country to which we're now turning over all of our most advanced weapons. Their long-term goals, what they want in the world, is not what we want. It contradicts what we want. But look at Iran. Number one, Iran is the militant enemy of radical Sunni groups like Taliban and Al-Qaeda, whose leaders want to kill all Shiites. They hate the Shia of Iran even more than they hate Christians and Jews or anybody else. Those are the infidels from within. So Iran is very much on our side, not on the side of Al-Qaeda and Saudi Arabia. Look at our other great friend, ally, Pakistan. Here, we're a country we're sending billions of dollars to help us fight the Taliban, but at the same time they're doing that, they're supporting the Taliban. These are alliances that don't make sense over the long run. So Iran shares our concern about the growth of these radical fundamentalist groups in the Sunni Middle East. Number two, Iran has great ability to help stabilize Iraq. Iran can probably do more to stabilize Iraq than any country in the world, including the United States. We are desperate to get out of Iraq. The only fear that we have, of course, is that it will explode again in another round of this horrific violence that we saw in the first couple of years after the American invasion. Iran can make sure that doesn't happen. Iran can be our ticket out of Iraq. This would require diplomatic assurances to Iran that we're not going to use a peaceful, stable Iraq as a platform to attack Iran. Nonetheless, a stable Iraq is very much in Iran's interest, and Iran has great ability to stabilize it for us if they want to, if they have incentives to do so. Look on Iran's other border, Afghanistan. Another huge conundrum for the United States, if anything, even bigger than Iraq. Now, how are we going to resolve that terrible situation in Afghanistan? Iran also has great ability to help stabilize Afghanistan. The whole western part of Afghanistan used to be part of Iran up until Iran lost a war in the 18th century. The language they speak is identical to the Farsi that is spoken in Iran. Iran has deep ties inside Afghanistan and had a lot of buttons to push. It was Iran that connected us with the Northern Alliance when we wanted to overthrow the Taliban. They have worked with us in the past, before we put them on the evil empire list, to stabilize Afghanistan. They can also help us do that now. You can go on and on with this list of strategic convergences. Iran is very eager to maintain the steady flow of oil from the Persian Gulf to the West. Iran wants to keep Russian influence out of the Middle East. This is a stated goal of American policy. Iran's oil industry, the infrastructure, is in a state of complete collapse. It needs tens of billions of dollars of foreign investment to bring it up to modern standards. American companies are the best placed in the world to do that work. There's even a job for Halliburton in all this. Everybody can benefit. So, over the long run, Turkey and Iran make the best sense as allies or partners for the United States in that part of the world. Now, how do we get there? Certainly, dealing with this current regime in Iran would be very difficult. Nonetheless, we have not exhausted our opportunities. In fact, we've hardly even begun to test them. We have never really tried the diplomatic channel with Iran, and we are not trying it now. Our present policy toward Iran is that to demand that Iran must negotiate with us to achieve curbs on Iran's nuclear program. But if you put yourself in Iran's shoes, there's no reason to enter into such a negotiation. Why would you want to enter into negotiations on only the one issue that your enemy is concerned about? the way to begin negotiations with Iran is to open the agenda. I've gone back and looked at the way the U.S. opened its relations with China after a long period of hostility. And those of you that are old enough to remember can recall that the way we denounced Red China in the Dulles era was even more intense than what we're saying about Iran right now. This was the Antichrist incarnate. But President Nixon, I'm in a way happy my parents aren't alive to hear me say anything good about Richard Nixon, but Nixon realized that the pieces on the global chessboard are not welded into place. You can move them around. Just because we've been hostile to a country for a long time doesn't make that permanent. So when he began the process of reconciliation with China, he began it with a document that I've now gone back to read called the Shanghai Communique. This was a very interesting document, very short. It contained no agreements. That came later. It had three short parts. The first part was written by the Chinese side. Everything we don't like about America and America's policy toward us and what America does in the world. Second part, written by us. What we don't like about China and what China does and what China is. Third part, we agree to negotiate on all these issues and not to resolve them by force. So essentially, it's just an agenda. You tell me everything you don't like about me, I'll tell you everything I don't like about you, and then let's go through the list and see if we can come up with a package that will satisfy both of us. We have never gotten to this point with Iran. We have never even asked Iran the fundamental question, what would it take for you to agree to do what we want with your nuclear program? What would you want in exchange? We can't even begin the debate over whether that's enough to give or too much to give. We don't even know what it is. The only policy that we are following in the Middle East toward Iran is the policy of sanctions and denunciation. Now, these sanctions are very destructive in Iran. I've seen it myself. Their greatest impact, and this is the same thing I saw when I covered Iraq, when Saddam was under sanctions, and when I covered Yugoslavia, when the Milosevic regime was under sanctions. This criminal class of gangsters connected to the government emerges. They're the sanctions busters. You can still buy a General Electric refrigerator in any store in Tehran, but it's brought in by sanctions busters. Those sanctions busters are the Revolutionary Guard. They are making huge amounts of money off the American sanctions, and that is the most repressive aspect of the entire Iranian political system. We are funding them and fueling them and empowering them through our sanction regime. Now, in this sense, I actually could see a comparison between Israel and Iran. In one sense, I see them in a similar position. These are two countries in the Middle East that are mistrusted by many of their allies, and they're hated by many people all over the world. There's a great deal of anti-Iran emotion in the world, and there's a great deal of anti-Israel emotion in the world. To redeem those emotions, the thing to do is to denounce, to demonize, to push these countries into a corner and to isolate them and sanction them. That makes us feel good, those of us that don't like one country or the other country or both of them. But that does not get us any closer to where we need to be in the Middle East. That does not provide any advance towards stability. What we need to do is entice these countries somehow out of their isolation and out of their anger. When I was in Iran, too, I spoke to many ordinary people and asked them, would it be moral, would it be acceptable to you if our government in Washington were to negotiate with your government that just finished beating you and repressing you and evidently stealing an election? Or should we isolate them? Every person I spoke to told me essentially the same thing, which is our movement, this green movement that emerged after the last election, doesn't have any good options now. We're in a bad situation. The best of all the bad options would be if somehow our regime could be enticed out of its anger and out of its paranoia. And the admiration that ordinary Iranians have for the United States is such that everybody would welcome a real diplomatic overture. We are not on the diplomatic path now. We are only on the sanctions path. And even the people that are directing the sanctions program for us admit that it's not going to work. It's not going to force the Iranians to do what we want them to do and say, okay, we surrender, we're not going to follow any more nuclear projects, we'll do whatever you want. That's never going to happen. And even our leaders in Washington admit this. So why are we sanctioning them at all if it's having this negative effect of empowering the Revolutionary Guard and no positive effect? It's so that later on, a president will have the opportunity to say, oh, we tried everything. We tried negotiating. We went to Geneva. We tried sanctions. We tried everything peaceful. It didn't work. So we are now laying the groundwork for a potential military option. I would like to see our policymakers open their minds to these new alternatives. The problem is that the foreign policy establishment in Washington requires everybody to accept a whole series of paradigms and assumptions that have shaped our policy over the past. Those were the assumptions that worked in the past. But for the future, they don't work anymore. And if you're outside that narrow spectrum of acceptable opinion, you're kind of stigmatized, and you'll never eat lunch in this town again. You have to accept a whole series of assumptions and keep yourself locked in that straitjacket of past policies. Original thinking is looked at as a bacteria of some terrible plague that must be stamped out before it could spread throughout the entire policy process. Reminds me of a line I once read from Dorothy Parker. She was asked to describe what she thought of Katharine Hepburn's acting style. And she said, she runs the gamut of emotion from A to B. That's our policy toward the Middle East. We are caught in that really narrow spectrum, and we don't open up our minds to other possibilities that might be out there to deal with entirely new realities. Or, to quote one of the great Persian poets, who is now buried in what's now Turkey, Rumi, he said something which just encapsulates, I guess, the message that I would like to address to our leaders in Washington and those shaping particularly our policy toward the Middle East. Rumi wrote, "Why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open?" Thank you.
Stephen, that's terrific. I wish we had more time to hear you talk more, but we're going to get that time because we've got a whole bunch of questions we're going to ask. First of all, Turkey would like us to abandon our confrontational stance towards Iran. You say we don't take advice from our allies, but doesn't the confrontational stance come from U.S. grassroots? In other words, if the government took the advice, wouldn't the electorate in the United States reject what the government would do?
I do go to Washington once in a while, as infrequently as possible, but I was there recently giving speeches on this same topic, and a guy came up to me who is a part of the national security team in the White House. And he said to me, you know, I think we would probably agree with one thing you said, which is that our policy toward the Middle East isn't working. What we don't know is, number one, what could be the new policy, and number two, how would we sell that to the electorate? I guess this is what your questioner is wondering about. I can understand. It would be difficult for an American president to stand up and say, hey, it's time for us to embrace that Israel-hating, Holocaust-denying, demonstrator-beating, women-stoning president of Iran. Now, this is not a good start. First of all, I think we need to separate the people of Iran from the regime, but more important is this. Here's how I would frame it. Let's do what every other country in the world does in shaping foreign policy. Let's ask ourselves, what's good for us over the long run? What do we need to do as the United States to be sure that in 50 years, our position in the world is somewhat similar to what it is now? We need to consider our own interests. And if even George Washington, one of my favorite quotes from him is, no nation should be trusted further than it is bound by interests. Let's look at our own interests. Reconciliation with Iran is not about giving away something. It's not about sitting around the campfire and singing Kumbaya because we think that's a much better thing to do than shout at people. It's in our own interests. And if we look forward in the Middle East, we are looking forward to a situation that's not going to stay the way it is. It's deteriorating. And the cyclotron, the centrifuges in Iran are spinning. The situation is getting more and more urgent. And if we take it as urgently as we pretend to take it, we should be asking ourselves more urgently, what can we do to resolve it?
Okay, the next one is an issue you did not raise, but where, from your perspective, does the whole Palestinian-Israeli situation fit in, and what should we be doing about it, or is it essentially irrelevant?
There is no major security goal of the United States in the Middle East that can be reached without Iran. We will not have a nuclear-free Middle East. We will not have a reduction in sectarian tensions in Lebanon. We will not have a stable democratic Iraq. We will not have an evolution in Syria, nor will we have a Palestinian-Israeli peace until Iran is brought to the table. They need to be under the tent rather than outside shouting in. Now, Iran's policy towards the Israel-Palestinian issue has become very clear. Their line is, whatever the Palestinians would accept, we will accept. This is very important for us because Iran has levers in the Middle East. Those factions that are militant, that we consider obstacles to peace, particularly Hamas and Hezbollah, respond to Iran, for better or worse. That means Iran can be a key in reducing the tension in that conflict. And despite what you're hearing from President Ahmadinejad, relations between Iran and Israel have actually been quite warm for some decades. And if you want to go further back, relations between Persians and Jews have been very warm over most of human history. It was the Persian king Cyrus who released the Jews from their Babylonian captivity. I read it in the Bible. It must be true. So the possibility that Iran could actually be a force for peace in the Israel-Palestine question, I think, is very real. Iranians are not so invested in the Palestinian cause as Arab people are who live in that part of the world. Don't forget, Iran is not an Arab country. Turkey also not an Arab country. And as far as the American approach to that problem in Israel and Palestine is concerned, I would just say this. Friends don't let friends drive drunk. We are careening towards a real crack-up in the Israel-Palestine issue. I don't believe that in the long run Israel will be able to defend itself with military means alone. If you look at the geography of the region, and then you factor in the changing demography, you realize that long-term Israel is in danger if it maintains its complete isolation from the countries around it. Anything that helps stabilize the neighborhood is what's going to help guarantee Israel's long-term security interests. Reconciliation with Iran and a calming down of Iran as a destabilizing factor in the Middle East will calm that neighborhood. Therefore, it is good for Israel, even if the current leaders of Israel, who must respond to domestic politics, would not agree.
This is a follow-up on the Israel thing. Turkey and Israel have had positive relationships in recent years. How damaging to that relationship was the whole Gaza incident this
You're right that Turkey has had very good relations with Israel. It was the first Muslim country to recognize Israel, and relations between Turks and Jews have also been very good. When no European country would take Jewish professors who were fired from German universities in the 1930s, and the United States wouldn't take them either because universities here weren't hiring Jews, almost 300 of them went to Turkey and formed the basis of a new Istanbul University. Atatürk invited them all. They came as early as 1492 from Spain to Turkey. There was a time when, in the 18th, 19th century, when most of the Jews in the world were living under the rule of the Ottoman Empire. So this is also a very long relationship. It has been damaged, at least superficially, by the Marmara flotilla incident, that ship that was attacked by Israeli commandos while it was on its way trying to break the blockade of Gaza. I don't think this reflects any intense anti-Israel feelings in Turkey as much as it reflects anger at the treatment of Palestinians, particularly in Gaza. We're kind of isolated from that situation. It's far away. But in Turkey, people are watching the Gaza situation every day on their TV. They're watching what's happening in the West Bank every day. Every outrage is played over time after time. Anger has really grown in Turkey over the treatment of Palestinians. And I think that's what lies behind the Gaza flotilla and then the crack-up that happened after commandos killed 9 Turkish citizens. Now, Turkey has never in its history had civilians killed by uniformed soldiers of another army. All the problems they ever had with Greece, their confrontations with Russia, they never had this before. So this is a huge shock in Turkey that soldiers of another country on the high seas boarded a ship and killed 9 of their citizens. There's a lot of anger about this, and Turkey is now demanding an apology. Otherwise, they're going to maintain a greater distance from Israel. The job of diplomats now is to come up with some statement that seems like an apology in Turkey, but doesn't seem like an apology in Israel. That's what diplomats do. I would just say this. I understand the emotion that drives Turkish anger. On the other hand, our problem, America's problem in the world, and particularly our problem in dealing with Iran, is we're the prisoners of emotion. We're still angry at Iran because of the hostage incident and everything else they've done to us. Emotion is the number one enemy of wise statecraft. You need to leave your emotions outside the room and talk practically about interests. When I advise America to do this, I also advise Turkey to do it. The Turkish-Israel relationship is still strong. The military-to-military relationship is strong. Turkey is still the number one destination for Israeli tourists. Nonetheless, it would be also a good idea for Turkey to try to cool its emotion, because Israel ultimately is going to need a bridge out of its isolation. The only Muslim country in the Middle East that can provide that bridge is Turkey. Therefore, it's good for Turkey, which needs a stable Middle East, to maintain a good relationship with Israel despite its emotional desire to remain angry.
Okay. Here's a question about Turkey and the EU, and considering what's going on in the EU these days, maybe Turkey doesn't want to be in. But do you think it's important, from Turkey's perspective, that it join the EU? And if so, how can Germany and France be persuaded to help?
Turkish entry into the EU would be a great benefit for both parties. It would be good for Europe, because Europe, with Turkey, can really be a force in the world. Turkey is its bridge to the Islamic world. It can help spread EU ideas in the Islamic world. Don't forget also, Turkey has a real army. You know, Turkey knows how to fight. You don't have to go to war with the Danish army or the Portuguese army. They really know how to fight. So this could make Europe a military and political force in the world, which I think would be a good thing, because I support the ideals that lie behind the European Union. Turkey also is full of young, vibrant workers who are eager to work and pay taxes so that the retired people in Germany will be able to have their pensions. Well, otherwise, I don't know who's going to pay for them. It's good for Turkey, too, for a different reason. For the last few years, the prospect of EU membership has been the principal outside dynamic propelling the process of democratic reform inside Turkey. When you remove that dynamic, the process of reform in Turkey slows down, and that's bad for everybody. So why isn't it happening? Well, first of all, Europe is in a huge identity crisis now. Europe doesn't know what it is or what it wants to be or what it wants to do. The idea that they would suddenly take in 70 million Muslims who are going to need various kinds of economic support is just not something that Europe is prepared to deal with at this time. Also, the European Union has become more democratic. You know, it wasn't up until 10 years ago, the European Union was a totally top-down project. For example, the euro would never have been introduced if the people of Europe had been allowed to vote on it. I was in Germany when that was happening. Everybody in Germany was against it. But it was just ordered from the leaders. That's the way representative democracy can work. But now, people in Europe have more to say. Many of the leaders in Europe understand the value of Turkey, but the people don't. People are not ready for it. There are many votes to be gained in many European countries by vowing never to let the Turks breach our gates. Until that changes, it's not going to be possible for Turkey to join. Turkey was founded as a republic in 1923, so that means the 100th anniversary will be in 2023. That might be the most optimistic guess for Turkey to join the European Union, but as you pointed out, Mac, who knows what's going to happen by then? That we might get to the point where the European Union is actually applying to join Turkey.
One final question on Turkey, then we'll switch to Iran. Discuss a little bit about the AKP, the AK Party in Turkey. Is it really still democratic? What's going on with all the journalists they've put in jail? What's their long-term ambition from your point of view?
I talked about Turkey as a country that's able to adapt as times change. Turkey was a semi-authoritarian state up until 10 or 15 years ago. The military was really the ruling power behind the democratic facade, at least on issues that the military cared about. The world was changing. The world didn't want that kind of system anymore. At the same time, a new class of Turks was emerging, the product of the reforms that President Özal imposed in the 1980s. Özal urged Turks to go out and try to get rich, and he made credit available to them, and he built all sorts of infrastructure projects throughout the country. That promoted the emergence of a whole new class, something we have not seen in any country in the world, and that is pious Muslims who pray every day, who are totally Europe-oriented and 100% capitalist and want to maintain a democratic society and relations with the outside world. We're not used to this. The party that comes out of Islamic politics is supposed to be the one that's against Europe and the West and democracy. In Turkey, it's the other way around. Now, this party, the Justice and Development Party, AKP, challenged the ultra-secularist elite that had been essentially ruling Turkey ever since Turkey was founded. One response would have been to do what, for example, Egypt has done with the Muslim Brotherhood. It's to say, we're going to make sure you never win an election. The last election just this past week, Muslim Brotherhood got zero seats in parliament. None. Amazing how those votes are counted in Egypt. So the regime makes a decision that a certain force in society must be kept out of power. And the political system is then manipulated to make sure that happens. That's very destabilizing for societies in the long run because those groups become isolated, they become angry, then they're outside the system. That didn't happen in Turkey. The political system was open enough to invite that new class and its new political party to participate freely, and that class has now come to power. You do see in Turkey now more visible signs of religiosity than you used to, and certainly secularist rhetoric does not dominate the public airwaves the way that it used to. This is very disconcerting for many people, including for most of my Turkish friends. They're very worried about where this is leading. But what's really happened is not so much that Turks became more religious. It's that the lid was taken off as democracy was consolidated, and people were allowed to be who they really are. So for 70 years, all Turks had to pretend that they were ultra-secularist. And they didn't see any role for religion in public life, and all they wanted to do was be militantly against the clerical class like Atatürk was. Well, now they don't have to be anything. You can be what you want in Turkey. And surprise, many Turks are still religious believers. So I don't see the threat of Islamization of Turkey, that Turkey's going to become the next Iran. Nonetheless, I do feel that the leaders of Turkey have not done enough to reassure the old secular class that enjoyed being in power for so long that their position is secure. As a result of his failure to do so, Turkish society is becoming more polarized. This is very dangerous. Turkey is playing a hugely positive role in the world now. It is a peace broker in many countries, within countries and between countries. But there's an upper limit, there's a ceiling to how effective Turkey can be until it resolves some of its own domestic problems, including its treatment of minorities, and this other problem of increasing polarization along the religious secular lines. For Turkey to play the very productive role that it can play in the world, it needs to spend more time addressing its domestic problems, and one of the main ones is the restiveness and the unhappiness that many traditional secularists are feeling at the course that the current government is following.
We're running out of time, unfortunately, because we've got some great questions, but I'm going to ask two questions which are coming at Iran from entirely different angles. The first one is, America is a democracy. How does our government convince our citizens that the country, Iran, that took our embassy hostage in the 1970s should become our friends diplomatically in the future? That's one question. The other one is, why hasn't the Obama administration been more aggressive in compromise and diplomacy with Iran? This is really a political question. When they have compromised so much with Republicans on so many issues.
Just briefly addressing that first question, as I said, I feel that the only way Americans as a nation will change our view about Iran is to be shown how much we have to gain from a better relationship with Iran. I'm not sure that such a negotiation could produce the new security architecture in the Middle East that I think is urgently necessary. But I can tell you one thing, if we don't do it, we're never going to get there. Military force is not a substitute for diplomacy. Diplomacy can achieve our goals in that part of the world. If it can't, we should at least try to find out. We have not tried that option yet. Why have we not tried it? One thing I have really been impressed by in watching Obama over the last couple of years is how effective the foreign policy establishment is in pulling everybody who shows up in Washington into its nefarious clutches. It's remarkable to me how fully President Obama embraced what is essentially the same policy we followed toward Iran in the last few years of the Bush administration. Giving President Obama his due, he's got a few other projects in mind. He's got a little bit on his plate. And I don't think that he has ever really spent a lot of concentrated time thinking about global affairs and international security issues. He's never had a job where he had to do that. In his past jobs, he's thought a lot about the environment and energy and labor and other domestic issues. But I don't think he's ever read deeply or thought deeply about the outside world. What I think we need is the boldness to say what we're doing in the past, what we've been doing in the past, is not working. And for our own national interest, we need to change course. I believe this could be a part of a larger attempt by our president to appeal to the side of Americans, which sometimes I wonder if it even exists, and that's the side where it thinks about long-term challenges. One of my friends recently returned from Germany, and he told me every single person I met there, whether it was an academic or a politician or a business leader, is all thinking about the same thing. What can we do now to be sure that in 50 years, Germany is still prospering and booming like it is today? That's all they're thinking about. But we in America are not thinking about that. It doesn't take much intelligence to figure out that countries that spend a lot of time thinking about their future are going to have better futures than countries that don't think about their future at all. So I would sell the reconciliation with Iran project, first of all, on the basis of the national interest that can accrue to us in saving American lives in Iraq and Afghanistan to start with and stabilizing the world's most turbulent region, and then secondly, broadening it out and making this part of a new approach to dealing with the long-term future. We are not good at this as Americans, but we need to realize that these are challenges we need to grasp onto. Or, as Hamlet once remarked, I know not why yet I live to say this things to do, since I have cause and will and strength and means to do it. Thank you.